From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are following a lot of big news today from the Republican National Convention, where President Trump will speak tonight, to developments in Kenosha, Wisconsin, to, of course, Hurricane Laura.
The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Laura has weakened to a Category 2 storm since making landfall as the strongest storm to hit the state in more than a century. Laura came ashore at Cameron, Louisiana, near the border with Texas, early this morning as a Category 4 storm with sustained winds of 150 miles per hour. The Hurricane Center warned that unsurvivable storm surges of 15 feet or more could overwhelm parts of the Gulf Coast. NPR's John Burnett joins us on the phone now. And John, describe what you're seeing for us.
Well, I'm actually on a remote road way down here in the marshland, almost in the Gulf, deep in the wetlands, a few miles from where Laura hit last night. Conditions are getting worse and worse. A lot of lines are down. Big oak trees have lost their limbs. These beautiful houses on the marsh on stilts, some of them have lost some of their roofs and, outbuildings. I'm trying to get to Holly Beach, so we'll see how that goes. But it's been remarkable how just a difference a few miles make. I was over in Beaumont last night, which received almost no damage and no stormwater whatsoever. And yet you come over here to Louisiana and you can see that it was a monster storm.
And you're trying to get to Holly Beach because you've heard that there's been a lot of damage there.
Yeah, it's not far from Cameron, which was where the eye crossed. The damage, it's very hard to get into Lake Charles unless, your reporter who rode the hurricane out there last night, which I didn't. We've certainly seen pictures of a lot of structural damage, a lot of buildings and residences that lost their roofs, that windows were blown out, just, hotels pulverized by this 120 mile per hour wind. It was really a breathtaking hurricane.
What are the evacuation efforts looking like in light of COVID?
Well, I've covered a lot of these, Tanya, and this is unusual because rather than open up these big crowded shelters with, communal eating and cots all next to each other, they're doing that as a last resort. These communities are really urging people to get to cities where there are hotel rooms like Austin and San Antonio and Dallas and Shreveport and Baton Rouge and, hunker down in social distancing. They don't, it's bad enough that you have a hurricane, raking across the state, much less spreading coronavirus.
What are also some of the other biggest concerns right now?
Well, this is a huge complex of petrochemical plants and refineries, Tanya, and they've all gone down. And so, the United States depends on a consistent flow of gasoline. And so if they stay down for much longer, it's going to disrupt that flow. And we'll see the results in gas stations and maybe and in prices. So all these giant refineries are going to have to take stock and see when they can reopen. And then I-10 is closed as well. Interstate 10 is a major, trucking corridor between the East and West United States. And it's closed down for dozens and dozens of miles because of high water this morning.
That's NPR's John Burnett. John, thank you so much for this update, and please stay safe.
Thanks for asking.
Tonight, President Trump will headline the final night of the Republican National Convention. Last night, law and order was a central theme.
Shootings, murders, looting, and rioting occur unabated.
In recent months, we've seen weak, spineless politicians cede control of our great American cities to violent mobs.
Democrat-run cities across this country are being overrun by violent mobs. The violence is rampant.
The hard truth is, you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America.
That was Michael McHale, president of the National Association of Police Organizations, the president's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, and Vice President Mike Pence, all speaking last night. Let's bring in Republican strategist John Brabender, whose firm is working with the Trump campaign. John, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Well, I have to say, watching the programming last night with the convention, you wouldn't even realize that we're still in the midst of a pandemic. I know the Trump campaign would like to focus on other things, but is it a mistake for Republicans not to acknowledge in a bigger way the pain that people are feeling as a result of this virus?
Well, I think in total fairness, the vice president did an incredible job in talking about the pain. He talked about how families don't grieve. We grieve as a nation, every person that we've lost to this terrible pandemic that came on our shores like it came every place else in the world. I think he talked about, he gave a certain amount of hope, certainly, in saying that in this incredible race for the vaccine and the resources America is putting behind this, that it now looks promising that we'll have a vaccine by the end of the year. What I've noticed, I think, is a distinction between the Republican convention and the Democrat is the Republicans are also saying, but where do we also go from here? I think Americans want to know both of those. I think they want to know that the government is doing everything possible in fighting this terrible pandemic. But at the same time, what is the long-term plan economically for getting us back to where we were?
But in terms of the government doing everything possible to deal with the pandemic, I mean, many people would point to the fact that it took President Trump a long time to get around to the idea that wearing masks was really useful in controlling this pandemic, or stop embracing hydroxychloroquine after a lot of experts said that wasn't the right way to go. But I take some of your points on that. I want to ask you, though, about what was talked about a lot last night, which was this message of law and order. This is Vice President Pence speaking last night.
The violence must stop, whether in Minneapolis, Portland, or Kenosha. Too many heroes have died defending our freedom to see Americans strike each other down. We will have law and order on the streets of this country for every American of every race and creed and color.
Pence also said, "You will not be safe in Joe Biden's America." Is this going to be the central message of the campaign for the next couple of months?
Well, look, we're in unprecedented times where we have a pandemic, we have the economy, we have racial considerations. We're still having ongoing conflicts, at least economically, with people like China. So we're never going to have a central theme for here to Election Day. There's too many broad things. I think there's a couple of things, though, relative to law and order that was very, very important that the vice president said. First of all, he said that he and President Trump will always support the peaceful protest of people having their right to go out, express their beliefs, and be protected, being able to do that. And I think most Americans would agree with that right. I also think most Americans agree, though, that burning down businesses, shooting people, hurting people, starting fires, violence, making terroristic threats, those are not something that we should accept as a country. And I think, again, what the vice president said is we're not going to allow that. We are one American.
But you're saying that as if it's future tense. I mean, President Trump is in office right now. When you say we're not going to allow that, if what you're saying is actually happening, isn't that his responsibility?
Yeah, I think Wisconsin is probably a good example where they're now asking for support to come in to help that. And again, you got to remember, in many of these cases, it's the governors who have to take responsibilities. And so, the vice president also played a video two nights ago where he interviewed an African-American woman from Pennsylvania, where they talked about the other thing we have to do, though, is sit down and as communities talk through and listen to everybody. This doesn't have to be always violence. This can be a dialogue. And this administration has shown a commitment to willing to do that. I mean, look, this administration can stand on and say, look at our commitment financially that we made to African-American colleges and universities around this country. Look at what we actually did on criminal justice reform. Well, before anybody else was successful in doing this, it was this president.
We haven't heard anything during this convention about how to deal with the systemic racism that exists in law enforcement that is the root of some of these protests around the country.
Well, but let's contrast that. What is the Democrat solution? Let's dismantle the police. I mean, Joe Biden has sat there and said he agreed with the defund the police crowd.
No, he doesn't agree with defunding the police. He specifically said, John, that he doesn't agree to defund the police.
But he has listened time and time again to the sort of Democrat socialist, the most liberal left-leaning part of the party, and that's where the weakness of Joe Biden comes in. I think that we don't have to find it paradoxical to say that we're going to help and want to help the African-American community in whatever way we can, at the same time saying what we're not going to allow is the destruction and the violence that's happening at the same time.
That is Republican strategist John Brabender, whose firm is working with the Trump campaign. President Trump will speak tonight. John, thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be on.
Most schools in America are starting the school year remotely. That's what Leander Independent School District in Texas did. But starting on September 8th, the district will bring some students back into the classroom for in-person learning. Dr. Bruce Gearing is the district's superintendent and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for having me today.
Well, and tell us about your plan. How is this going to work for students who wish to return to school in person?
So we'll be starting out with about 25% of our student population coming back on September 8th. And we will keep that level of population for the first 2 weeks, and we will start to bring more students back after that.
And how do you decide which students get to come back in that first round, or is it up to them and their parents?
Actually, we do have criteria that we've put into place. We are inviting our highest special needs students to come back, as well as our youngest learners. And so our pre-K and our kindergarten and our first grade students will be invited back in that first round. At the middle school level, we'll be bringing back our sixth graders, and at the high school level, our ninth graders in that first round. We will also be including our staff children so that they have a place to be learning as our staff come back to help with all of the in-person instruction.
And are teachers, all the teachers, are they going to have to be back in the classroom as well?
So we are requiring all of our staff to return on September 8th, with the exception of a few who have applied for accommodations through our human resources department.
And how will they both teach the students who are there in person and the ones who are learning from home?
So we have two different models that we're working with. At the elementary level, we will have teachers who are teaching only in-person students and other teachers who are only teaching virtual students. At the middle and high school level, all of our teachers will be teaching both in-person and virtual students. So the in-person students will be receiving the same online instruction as our virtual students. The synchronous part of that is the first 45 minutes where the teacher will be instructing all of her students virtually, including the students who are in person in her classroom. And then in the second 45 minutes, the students in the classroom will be interacting with each other and interacting with the teacher in person, while the students who are still at home and virtual will be in breakout rooms and interacting with each other or working independently. And they may also consult with the teacher virtually if they need any help.
The other piece of this, of course, is that you're going to have to make sure that there's not an outbreak of COVID-19 in the school. And in order to do that, many places are doing a lot of testing. Do you have plans to do a lot of COVID-19 tests, regular tests for the people who will be in the building?
We are not going to be doing any additional testing apart from what is already happening in our county. And we, of course, are focusing on the three main things, which are masks, social distancing, and hand washing to try to ensure that all of our staff and students remain safe.
What kind of reaction are you getting from parents and students to this plan?
So, of course, we have a mixed reaction. There are a number of parents who really want their kids back in person in school and are asking us to do that as soon as possible. We have some who do not want their children back in school. They, of course, have the choice to keep their students 100% virtual. It's a little more challenging for our staff. They really don't have as much choice as our students and our parents have, and that has been challenging for us to manage.
If there is a spike in cases, will you change course and go back to all online learning?
Just like when we have bad weather, we consult meteorologists. So in this global pandemic, we're working very closely with the health departments and especially the epidemiologists. So we will be watching the numbers very carefully. We will be monitoring our own situation in each classroom and making those decisions as necessary.
Mm-hmm. So you're consulting with the experts, but how does it feel to you as a superintendent to be responsible for all of this at this moment? Something obviously that nobody's really been able to prepare for at the level of a superintendent of a school district.
Absolutely. You know, I am a math teacher by trade, and I never dreamed that one day I'd be building school buildings and managing this many students. And this is a new situation, and that requires us to be highly flexible and adaptable. And we're going to make decisions in the best interests of our staff and our students, and we're going to do the very best that we can in very, very challenging circumstances.
Are you moving in this direction, though, because an in-person class is better in terms of quality than an online class, or because there's economic pressure to get the kids back into the classroom so that the parents can go back to work, or some combination?
I think it is a combination of both of those things. We know that we're a human capacity organization, and we do our best work when we have personal human connections and relationships between students and teachers and students and students. But we also know that we don't understand everybody's personal circumstances at their house, and we want to provide those opportunities, if at all possible, safely, in order to mitigate what could be, you know, dire consequences for families that may really need their kids to be back in school for some reason. That's why we're trying to operate under as much choice as possible. Of course, that requires us to have both in-person and virtual opportunities for them, which requires that we operate under a full staff as soon as possible.
That is Dr. Bruce Gehring, who is the superintendent of the Leander Independent School District in Leander, Texas, which is currently teaching online, but will soon, on September the 8th, give students the option to attend school in person. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with this.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professional sports teams from several leagues have taken a dramatic step to raise awareness about racial injustice. In an unprecedented move, the Milwaukee Bucks decided not to play Game 5 of their first round of the playoff series. Three other NBA games were also called off, and teams from the WNBA, Major League Baseball, and Major League Soccer followed suit. Let's bring in Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN. And Howard, you've been covering sports for a while. How would you characterize this moment?
Well, I think it's a remarkable moment. I think that especially in the case of the NBA, it just takes a tiny bit of a history lesson. Let's not forget that 6 years ago, when the NBA had the Donald Sterling affair with the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, the players threatened to boycott the playoffs if he was not removed as an owner. And it took some diplomacy from the new commissioner, Adam Silver. And the players went up to the line, but they did not cross it. And they ended up playing, and the games resumed. And then Colin Kaepernick took a knee. The basketball still went on. And you get to George Floyd. And there were many players before the restart that thought that maybe what was happening in the country was more important than resuming, and that basketball felt irrelevant. And yet the players still played. What happened yesterday was different. Yesterday seemed to be the breaking point for these athletes who had decided in unison that they weren't going to play. And in addition, you had other sports follow. Naomi Osaka, the great tennis player, she withdrew from the Western and Southern Open. And baseball, of all sports, it's only 7.7% black baseball players decided that they weren't going to play. The Dodgers, the Mariners, the Cincinnati Reds, Milwaukee Brewers, all they didn't play.
But I think what I'm hearing from you is that it's sort of a culmination. We can't look at all of these incidents as separate. They're kind of building on each other. This really gets to what you've been writing about. You said the player voice was heard so powerfully that for the first time in the sport's history, it toppled an owner. Explain what you mean by that.
The players have always been treated as chattel in so many ways, even though they are paid and they're paid enormous sums of money. Sports is an incredibly paternalistic place. And when the players begin to exercise their voices, normally they're shouted down by the public, they're ignored by ownership. And in this case, when we're talking about things from the social justice area, we've seen what has happened to Tommy Smith and John Carlos, and we saw what happened to Muhammad Ali years ago. We saw what happened to Colin Kaepernick. And in the case of the Clippers in 2014, they threatened, and management listened and this year, we've seen players make demands. We've seen players make their voices heard. And instead of being shouted down by the powers that be, they've had to listen. The players are also saying something else to the public. They're saying that these issues are important enough for you to pay attention to without being distracted by me. I'm not willing to contribute to the distraction.
Yeah, that is really interesting. You know, something else, there's a lot of debate on the language used to describe these actions by the players. Is it a strike? Is it a boycott?
Is it neither?
Is that a distraction?
I think it
depends. Is it neither?
Well, yeah. I think that language is extremely important, right? Is it a strike? No, it's not necessarily a strike because the players aren't demanding labor concessions. Is it a boycott? Not really, because normally when you boycott something, you're boycotting an outside entity. You're boycotting something that you're not a part of. So it's sort of in between. I think the way that I tried to couch it was simply to say that the players decided not to play as a form of protest.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver is really in an interesting position right now. How do you think he'll proceed?
It's an interesting position, and in some ways it's a completely uncomplicated one. It's interesting because the history of the sport and the history of all professional sports in America has been to always keep labor in its place. Especially if this were the NFL, you would see a much more draconian approach. But on the other hand, it's not very complicated because ever since George Floyd was killed in May, all of these sports have and all of these corporations have said that Black Lives Matter. They've said that they're in support. They've said that things have to change. Well, I can't think of a more appropriate time to back that up than right now. There was a movement before this, and I think that conversation is now being revived.
Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN. Thank you so much, Howard.
No, my pleasure.
Nearly 40% of colleges and universities are holding some form of in-person learning this semester, and schools that are inviting students back have put together rules in place to prevent coronavirus outbreaks. Students are expected to police themselves when they aren't in class, but as we've seen, that doesn't always happen. Coronavirus spikes blamed on partying college students has forced some schools to move from in-person to online-only classes. As Carrie Young with member station WBUR in Boston reports, stopping the spread relies on everyone doing the right thing.
That reliance on the honor system is making a lot of people nervous right now.
I just don't trust the student population as a whole to be responsible.
Miranda Rodea is a fourth-year student at Northeastern University. She says seeing a spike in coronavirus in her home state of Texas over the summer sealed the deal for her to stay home and learn remotely. And with most social events canceled, the cost of housing just wasn't worth it.
I just thought there's no point.
But even students who have decided to come back say they're worried.
I honestly, am a bit scared. I don't know if I should really, trust everybody.
Eliezer Meraz is also from Texas and also a fourth-year student at Northeastern. He had a hard time keeping up academically, living with his family, so the health risk of coming back to campus was worth it for him. Still, Meraz says there's a lot of uncertainty about the new school year.
We're just going to have to kind of just take it one step at a time as students, just kind of make the most of it, really.
For business owners who have long relied on students being around, the start of in-person classes is a welcomed event.
To be honest, we're excited to have the students back.
Billy Moran is the general manager of Cornwall's Pub, a popular bar near Boston University. He says the coronavirus pandemic has been devastating for business. Moran is hoping that with the students back, the family can make up at least some of their losses.
It is a little bit scary because we have people coming back from all over the world, but BU has spent the summer preparing, testing facilities and contact tracing abilities so that they are able to track and trace, and anything that flares up, they'll be able to isolate very quickly.
Northeastern is doing the same thing. Still, school leaders acknowledged there will be things that are outside of their control, like student activity and off-campus housing. Here's what Northeastern's Kathy Spiegelman told Boston City Councilors recently.
We are trying to create a community of caring where people understand what it means to come back and what it means for us all to share this space and this time, given everything.
Even in a typical college year, there are tensions between students living off campus and their neighbors. And that's why some Boston residents are especially nervous this year.
If you're ignoring a whole piece of this, then you're asking for an outbreak again in the fall.
Patricia Flaherty lives in the Mission Hill neighborhood near Northeastern University. She says colleges should take more time to develop better plans for policing behavior off campus.
And is that an acceptable risk? I don't know. I don't want to be one of the acceptable risk numbers.
But other nearby residents, like Pamela Lanes, who also runs a small barbershop in the neighborhood, remain cautiously optimistic.
You'd have to make a conscious decision that if you are going to come back, like quarantine, do everything that you need to do to ensure that you're not the one that's going to like spread anything.
She says she hopes students can hold themselves accountable, just like she is. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Young.
We're learning more about two people at the center of events in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Police say Rustin Shesky is the officer who shot Jacob Blake in the back on Sunday, igniting protests. Officials have also identified the 17-year-old from Illinois who allegedly shot and killed two protesters in Kenosha. Latoya Dennis is with Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. And Latoya, I want to start with Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old suspect on social media. He supported President Trump and the Blue Lives Matter movement. What more are we learning about why he was there?
Yeah, you know, he basically has said that he was there to help protect businesses. And he, from social media video that is circulating that was taken before the shooting, he said that, you know, it was his job to be there as though, you know, he was helping the police and he felt that that was here where he belonged. We know that growing up, he was part of a police cadet program and that, you know, he really loved police officers and appreciated the job that they do in communities.
We mentioned the officer who shot Jacob Blake, Rustin Shesky, who has not been charged. We didn't even know his identity until yesterday. What else do we know about the circumstances of the shooting and what repercussions he's likely to face?
Yeah, so at this point, when it comes to Rustin Shesky, as you said, his name was finally released yesterday by the Wisconsin Attorney General. He had been on the Kenosha Police Department for 7 years. And when it comes to what led up to that shooting, it said that Jacob Blake was at a home where his girlfriend lived. He wasn't supposed to be there. It sounds like there was some sort of restraining order. And the police were called. Shesky was one of the officers who showed up at some point. I'm not sure what happened, but officers used a taser on Blake that didn't work for whatever reason. That's when we see him walking around the vehicle. He opens the door, and then we see the officer grab his shirt and fire 7 rounds into Blake's back. At this point, we know that the Kenosha District Attorney has also asked for a federal civil rights investigation into the shooting right now, as the Wisconsin Department of Justice is also investigating the shooting.
What do we know about the condition of Jacob Blake at this point?
So at this point, Blake is paralyzed from the waist down. That's according to his attorney, Ben Crump, as well as his family. He was shot and he has injuries to not only his spinal cord, but his vertebrae. He's had a portion of his colon removed. He was shot in the arm. He has kidney and liver damage as well from the shooting. It's unclear as to whether the paralysis is permanent, although they're thinking it might be at this point.
And what about the demonstrations? They continue, I gather, and the White House has said as many as 2,000 National Guard troops are available for Kenosha. What is the situation with that?
Yeah, right now there are lots of police and National Guard members in Kenosha. There are federal agents already there, and there are more on the way. Governor Evers yesterday agreed to accept President Trump's help when it comes to that. And basically, there's a curfew in place from 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. that is expected to remain through Sunday. And protests are continuing. Last night, it's been said that they were quite peaceful. There were no people walking around with guns hoping to protect businesses. And the protesters largely stayed away from the courthouse, which had been the center of a lot of this in previous nights.
That is LaToya Dennis with Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. LaToya, thank you.
Thank you.
Officials in the Florida Keys have approved a controversial plan to manage mosquito-borne diseases by poisoning the bug's gene pool. Members of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District voted last week to approve the release of mosquitoes that have been genetically modified so the only viable offspring they produce are males. Only female mosquitoes bite humans, so supporters say it is a way of controlling the spread of diseases like dengue, Zika, and yellow fever without using pesticides. For more, we're joined by Phil Goodman, Commissioner and Chairman of the Board of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District. He's in Cudjoe Key. Commissioner, this is scheduled to start next year. What's your goal?
Well, what we would like to do would be to eradicate the mosquito-borne diseases brought by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is our public enemy number one here, which is the Zika, the dengue fever, the yellow fever, and the diseases you mentioned. We would love to be able to eradicate that, and that's our goal. In order to do that, you need to eliminate at least 90% of those mosquitoes to prevent local transmission, and that's our goal, to be able to do that. So we're really excited about having this opportunity.
Are you worried about unintended consequences of doing that, of releasing these genetically modified mosquitoes into the population?
No. We have been studying this for 10 years here within the mosquito control. You know, I'm a scientist. We have a big team of scientists within our mosquito control district here in the Florida Keys. We have gone through all types of regulatory evaluations. All of the people who are against this, they raised a lot of questions. They presented those to the regulators, specifically the EPA. The EPA looked at everything and put it in writing, answered every objection, and without exception, they found that none of these objections really held water, and that, you know, there was no impact, no negative impact on health, human life, wildlife, including endangered species, or the environment here in the Florida Keys.
So one of the critics, and this plan does have many critics, one of them is J.D. Hansen of the Center for Food Safety, who called this a Jurassic Park experiment. We remember in the movie Jurassic Park, they bred all the dinosaurs to be female, and Jeff Goldblum's character has the famous line. He says, you know, life will find a way. You can't stop it. What about that? What's your response to that?
Well, you know, we heard a lot of Jurassic Park type fear-mongering, basically, in my opinion. I think, you know, some people are just, in some organizations, are just against any type of genetically modified organism, no matter what it is. So they're automatically against it. In my opinion, it's a rather small but very vocal minority that are against this. And but by going through the regulatory process, we've been able to mitigate these objections, and we feel like this is a very safe process.
Well, just to give our listeners some context, though, more than 235,000 people have signed a petition online opposing this plan. They say the company that developed this genetically modified mosquito, Oxitec, wants to treat people like human experiments. Do you expect lawsuits to come?
There could be. And, you know, most of the people that signed the petition, you know, this was a written petition that had all kinds of erroneous information on it. And very few people from Florida and the Florida Keys actually participated in this. So, you know, there may be lawsuits, but, you know, we have all the approvals from everybody, in my opinion, that really matters. But, you know, we have to do something. The biggest fear here is dengue fever and all these diseases that this mosquito carries, not the Oxitec, genetically modified mosquito.
Well, what does it feel like to be fighting against diseases like dengue fever and Zika in this way in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, you know, we have to be able to do, you know, we didn't ask for this second virus to be here, but since it is, we have to address it, and we're addressing it every day. But, you know, we're very prone, you know, the Florida Keys, we're the undisputed hotspot of the mosquito-borne diseases in this country. And, you know, there are no vaccines, there are no therapeutic treatments. The only thing that you can do to control these diseases is to eliminate this mosquito. And like I said, you know, the biggest fear here is dengue fever and the fact that this board may not have acted, but we did act. And so we're ready to defend ourselves, and we think we did the right thing for the people of the Florida Keys.
And you think that this is a safer option than just spraying pesticides all over the place?
That's correct. You know, mosquitoes killing mosquitoes. This is what got my attention in the beginning. You know, what a novel idea. You know, I'm a chemist. I spent my entire career in the chemical industry. And the chemicals that we use for mosquito control are no longer effective against this mosquito. We're not going to be able to spray our way out of these diseases with traditional technologies. So we have to find new tools. And right now, you know, the sterile insect technique, which is this is one, really the only thing that's out there. There are no new chemicals on the horizon that will help us solve these problems. Thankfully, there are companies like Oxitec willing to invest in new technologies to give us hope for the future.
That is Phil Goodman, who is commissioner of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District, joining us from Cudjoe Key in Florida. Phil Goodman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Another 1 million people applied for unemployment benefits last week. And in Las Vegas, unemployment skyrocketed after hotels and casinos shut down back in March. One of those out of work is Benjamin Hernandez. He had been a restaurant busser for Park MGM for 24 years before being laid off last spring.
I really miss the interaction with the co-workers, with the guests, you know.
Casinos are slowly reopening, but former workers like Hernandez are now pushing the city to pass an ordinance called the Right to Return, which would require businesses to hire back laid-off staff. As the sole provider of his family, Benjamin Hernandez and I started our conversation by talking about how the last few months have been since he was laid off.
It has been difficult during the month that we had the stimulus help. It was okay. But right after that, it's kind of tough, you know, and it's concerning because I'm going to start taking money from my life saving to pay my mortgage, my utility bills, and so on and so on. It's kind of concerning.
Yes, you're referencing the stimulus package money, that extra $600. You're no longer getting that. And so now you're thinking about going into your savings. Tell me a little bit about your family.
I have four kids, but three of them are living on their own. It's just the youngest one living with me. He's 17, and my wife. And she's working just a part-time job right now. And I'm a cancer survivor, you know. I still in medical treatment and observation.
Do you have health insurance?
So far, yes. But it will be effective until October 31st. After that, we don't know what's going to happen.
As I mentioned, you are part of the Save Our Jobs Union Coalition fighting for the right to return, which would require employers to hire back former employees like you before offering those jobs to another person. Say more about what's at stake here.
Well, you know, it's very important for us to go back, you know, because we have been working with the company for so long, you know. We have invested great part of our lives, the company, and we've been getting good, you know, benefit, good wages and everything. But right now, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but some companies might try to use this, you know, as an opportunity to get rid of some of the guys that have been with the company for the longest time.
Because you've been there for 24 years.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I don't know if that's going to happen, but that could be a good opportunity. That's concerning, you know, and that's why we asking for the companies to call everybody back. You know, we understand that things are not going to get better right away, but, you know, as the business go back to normal, position these people back where they were.
What do you miss about work most?
We've been doing this for so long that we enjoy that atmosphere that's, you know, Vegas is such a unique place to be and work. And it's awesome. I miss all of that. I miss all the people, you know.
What will you do, though, if you can't go back to Park MGM? I know that you're going into your savings and that will last you for a little bit of time. But have you thought about the possible reality if this ordinance is not passed?
I thought about, you know, and yeah, I definitely have a plan B. I've been thinking about reinventing myself. So I've been thinking about maybe switching fields, you know, maybe going to auto mechanics, I was thinking about enrolling myself in class, you know.
You were nearing retirement, but you're not there yet. That's the point, is that you still have many years left, working years left. Is the city really looks at this idea of the right to return ordinance. What do you want city officials to consider?
Well, they need to consider that we are big contributors to the development of the city. We're a big part of this, and it's a lot of lives at stake, a lot of families, you know, that depend solely on this job. So now that we're going through all of these things in the nation, I think this is important, you know, the legislator pass some law or something to protect us workers.
You want them to acknowledge that you and so many others have been a part of building up what we now know is Las Vegas.
That is correct. That's the thing, you know, because we are the kind of workers that always backstage, you know, doing the little thing that make the thing look good. So now is the time for the companies to really show that they appreciate it, you know, because we are told all the time that we are the best asset they have and everything. So this is the time, you know, to show that love for us.
That's Benjamin Hernandez, a former busser at Park MGM in Las Vegas, Nevada. Benjamin, my very best to you, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And workers are asking the Clark County Commission to consider this ordinance on September 1st. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.